You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my first guest is John Guare, with whom I'll be speaking about Dawn Powell. There was a sort of literary flurry early in the year. There was a long essay by Gore Vidal about a writer named Dawn Powell who'd been neglected, and then more recently an essay by Jim Woolcott. But I thought these were, you know, typical shakings of the literary tree. The Vidal essay was to accompany a republishing of some of her books. The Woolcott, well, he's a Vidal fan and writes in Vanity Fair. But when I saw that a brand new press, the Yarrow Press, was publishing another of Dawn Powell's books, The Locusts Have No King, with an introduction by one of my favorite dramatists, John Guare, the author of The House of Blue Leaves and Bosoms and Neglect, Marco Polo Sings a Solo, and the film Atlantic City, she became someone I immediately wanted to track down, primarily because I can think of no one who's more peculiarly funny than John Guare, you know, a funniness that bookworms like. In fact, in his play Bosoms and Neglect, he talks a bit about neglected writers as well as neglected people. John Guare, how did you come across Dawn Powell?
Well, it's a great New York story. I mean, it's why we live in New York, in Greenwich Village. I got a call one day from Mike the Butcher at Jefferson Market. And he was calling. I said, "Mike, what's up?" And he said, "Well, I'm calling to say I'm leaving the Jefferson Market." I said, "Well, you are a great butcher, and my wife and I will follow you anywhere. You know, just let us know where you are." He said, no, I'm giving up being a butcher. I'm becoming a publisher." I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "Listen, you know, I know you're a writer." And he said, "I was wondering if you would write the preface to our first book." I said, sort of a little bit snooty, "Oh, really? Well, I'd love to read it." And he sent the book over with the order. And I sat down to read it, and it was, I was astonished. The book was so funny, just enchanting. And I really take that word literally. It took place in the village, right after the end of the Second World War, and it was just hilarious. And it was a level of sustained invention that I was dazzled by this woman, and I wanted to find. I had read Gore Vidal's piece, but I couldn't find anything by her. Everything was out of print, so I was sort of thrilled when Michael Miller, the publisher now,
the butcher,
sent the book over, and I finally read my first Dawn Powell.
Who was Dawn Powell?
Dawn Powell was burdened all her life by being the second Dorothy Parker.
Ah.
And she lived under that cloud. And she wrote two plays. This book is about the theater it's about a team of playwrights in New York in the 40s. And she sort of wrote about the generation after the 20s in the village, when, as the village still exists, it exists in your mind, but truly in your mind. I mean, the village is truly a magical place and truly a village, as where the butcher can call you up and say, "I'm becoming a publisher." And that's what she writes out of, the sort of the random pinball careening quality of New York City, all of us living together, bouncing off each other. And it was very extraordinarily carbonated, fizzy world that was also, in some alleged domain, extraordinarily touching.
In reading The Locusts Have No King, I thought a bit about the space-age socialites in your play, Marco Polo sings a solo. Do you feel an affinity with her as a writer?
I'll tell you something. I just, in the fact of just complete admiration, I mean, one just feels that any, you know, whether it's, Herman Melville or, I'm reading War and Peace right now, and I just, and it's a translation, not the Constance Garnett, but the translation that Oxford Press publishes by the Mauds, and it's so, the thing that I always know that, you know, War and Peace, the battle scenes are great, but thanks to this Maud translation, I didn't know that War and Peace also had the best party scenes ever written. And so you say, you know, I mean, listen, any writer or artist or singer or anything we like, if you find a shared sensibility, you say, well, my God, yes, that's me, that's part of me. And but I'm touched by Dawn Powell because she just kept on writing. She just kept on and kept on and kept on, and has just created a body of work that somehow managed to fall through the cracks.
In addition to Yarrow Press's publication of The Locusts Have No King, three other Dawn Powell books have been released, Angels on Toast, The Wicked Pavilion, and The Golden Spur by Vintage Press.
Yes.
Is it your feeling that she's a writer one can read and should read all of?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's just, yes, because it's a really, at the same time, it's a very familiar and, but so, such an original world, because it's the New York City that exists. I mean, she was a woman who came to New York from Ohio, and it still is the New York of, that ended up in MGM musicals. It's Woody Allen's Manhattan. It's George Gershwin's New York. I mean, it's the reason why New York is still a great city. I mean, and she draws with and not in any sentimental way, but Dawn Powell draws on that part of America that is hoping to transform itself into something great.
John Guare, are there anything that those of us in Los Angeles and those of us who are bookworms and theatergoers can look forward to from you?
Well, I've got a new play that we go into rehearsal with in a couple of weeks at Lincoln Center in New York. It's called 6 Degrees of Separation, and it'll be directed by Jerry Zaks, and who directed the revival of House of Blue Leaves at Lincoln Center, and designed by Tony Walton. And so we start that in a couple of weeks at Lincoln Center, and we'll start performing in the middle of May.
Oh, wonderful. And I was delighted to see a note in Premiere Magazine, I think a week ago, saying that you were at work on a new screenplay. Is that true?
But I mean, you know, as in screenplays, you live in steps, so I'm sort of at an early step.
One of those step deals. Well, those of us who are meanwhile waiting will all get Dawn Powell's The Locusts Have No King, published by the brand new press, Yarrow Press.
Yes, when the books, the first books off the press came in the Jefferson Market shopping bag, I'll tell you, it was 6 months after the call. I said this, because Michael and his wife, Ann Yurovsky, who started the press, are just, they're wonderful, and they're having a baby this week.
Yes, I was thinking the first book and the first baby, it really is a very, you know, bookish occasion.
And it's 85 here, so you just, it's beyond spring.
John Guare, are there any other novelists that you would like to point us toward?
Oh, yes! William Maxwell, published by Codeine Press.
They're bringing back all of him, I believe.
Oh, this guy is sensational. The Chateau, So Long, See You Tomorrow is, I mean, why these aren't the most famous books in American literature? I mean, they're wonderful.
So Long, See You Tomorrow, I believe, appeared in Totem in The New Yorker, where Maxwell is an editor, and the bookworm agrees, he's very well worth looking into, all of him on the way to being republished by Godin Press.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you very much for being with us, John
Guare. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk about this.
Thank you. My second guest today is Martin Amis, author of London Fields, just published by Crown Books, author, too, of The Rachel Papers, Dead Babies, Success, Money, Einstein's Monsters, a book of short stories, and two books of journalism. But it's London Fields that brings him here today. This is a ferocious and a ferociously funny book, and all day long I felt intimidated by the idea of having to interview you. Are you ferocious to interviewers?
No, I was ferocious to one or two once upon a time, and then got a reputation of being ferocious. But now I'm a puppy with interviewers. It's just that I think what sometimes happens is that an interviewer comes to see me. This is much more the case in England than anything I've experienced here. Comes to see me, and it all goes well enough, and then they go away. But hostility emerges at some point, and is certainly present in the piece they produce. And I suspect it's because of the way I write. That's the only it's the only explanation I can cobble together, that my prose is somehow hostile, and people feel picked on or exposed by it, and then go home and beat me up on their typewriters as a sort of proxy revenge.
London Fields, like several of your other books, uses the form, or at least the armature of a thriller, a detective story. Why do you find that useful?
I don't know. The deep reason may be that that I'm not very good at plots, perhaps, and I do believe that all the pleasures of fiction should be present. One should want to know what happens next. So what you get with me is a kind of deformed thriller, with usually the carpet being whipped out from under you at some point or other. But it may be that I just need a form to get writing with, because it's the writing, the characters that really thrill me. And the mystery, the what happens next, the who did it, the who done it, the why do it, the who'll do it, is a very obvious page-turning kind of form. I think I defeat myself sometimes because it means that occasionally I'm read too fast, because people, you know, the natural human curiosity, the desire to know how it all turns out, carries the reader along too quickly for what I'm really interested in, which is the prose and the people.
The sentence rhythms in this book are particularly wonderful, since they involve, in certain cases, incorporations of several different kinds of speakers, all appearing in the course of the prose of an American. Was it hard to take the risk of making a narrator an American novelist?
Well, he's an American, all right, but what he ain't is a novelist. He's a literalist, and he can't write. But when he comes to London, he finds that a real-life murder story is being enacted in front of his eyes, and that if he's smart and just keeps his mouth shut and just follows the action, he'll have a novel. I made him an American to give that extra element of strangeness to the thing, and that that I wanted an outsider's view. I mean, if I could have got a Martian to do it, then I would have been even happier.
Will there be a science fiction, Amis?
I flirted with science fiction here and in some short stories. But I don't know. I don't quite see myself writing a genre book.
Oh, I meant, you know, as a sort of ironic structure, a page-turning device.
A science fiction book. Well, my stuff is close enough to science fiction in that it redoes society a bit. I think it's sort of hot enough. It's feverish enough without, you know, needing a science fiction form.
At a certain point in the book, the world, as it exists in the book, a kind of on the verge of and nearly post-nuclear world is referred to as an iodized shithouse, a kind of Ezra Poundish excoriation, you know, blasphemous and horrible. The level of disgust in the book, that must be a great deal of fun to write.
Well, is disgust really the word we want? I have to go, I extrapolate from what I see around me, and I'm at the mercy of where my eyes go, you know. I mean, I think some people don't see when they walk down a street or whatever, they don't see what I see. They look, I don't know where they're looking, but it seems to me inexorable that my eyes will go to the gritty detail of what I see. Disgust is, doesn't seem to me a sort of writer's emotion, because, you know, even the blackest writer is in love with life, has to be, otherwise he wouldn't have the energy to put it down. He wouldn't have the, it's all an amorous business, writing, really. You love what you describe. On top of that, there's the moral twist in that we are kind of excited by what we most disapprove of, and that certainly comes into it.
But certainly the rhetorical strategies of disgust play a great part in this novel and in the others. Maybe we want to call it disenchantment.
Disenchantment. Well, I don't know about that either. I think there's a very funny, uneasy mixture of high and low, of wonder and disenchantment. I feel about the human species, I think, that profound disappointment often. You know, I think we could do better than we do. And one of the main accusations I would level at us is that we aren't enchanted enough, that revealed creation, and I mean that completely godlessly, should have us scratching our heads in wonder all the time. This accident, the Darwinian accident of our appearance on this planet, all that is full of wonder, and yet, you know, our horizons are stopped 2 inches from our noses, and we shoulder on.
In London Fields, recently published by Crown, you describe one of your characters as having breath that smells as if he'd been eating a mustard-covered camel, which, you know, made me very happy. and I guess surely one can't be disgusted by a world that can be described that way.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, let's stress again that the structures and the form is roughly comedy. Humor is the main energy. That's what I certainly feel. Comic invention is what I can identify when I sit down and write. And once you get laughing at these things, and get laughing at things that perhaps shouldn't be in comic novels, like villainy and misogyny, once you can laugh them off the stage, that's really the best punishment of all.
I wanted to ask about babies. As the author, the only book I haven't read of yours is one called Dead Babies, but here we have in London Fields a baby as marvelous as the infant Pantagruel is in the Rabelais book. Pantagruel has to find what he can use to wipe his bum, and being a giant, they bring sheep to try and all sorts of other things. You have a smaller baby, but one equally repellent. Why this animus toward the infantile?
Well, you know, you ought to say in fairness that the horror baby is balanced by the angel baby. There are two babies. And this is a simple demonstration of the way I work, in that, you know, every parent will tell you that each baby is heaven and hell, is a horror and an angel. So instead of having two middle-of-the-road babies who Yeah, sometimes you love them, sometimes you hate them. I divided the two qualities up and had one baby do all the nice things that babies do, perhaps to exaggerated, even sentimental degree, and came up with this comic nightmare for the bad baby. But, you know, babies are really ridiculous creatures. For one thing, they're very babyish. They're preposterously babyish. No adult would be allowed to behave like that. They'd be locked up, you know. And yet they get away with it. And I thought this had never really been done in fiction, the comic horror of the sort of things babies do.
A writer you've been compared to, Wyndham Lewis, who edited a magazine called Blast, once gave a list of instructions to people when they were leaving the heights of creativity and wandering around what he called the herd. He recommended gas masks. Do you have any suggestions for protection against the worst exigencies of modern life?
Reading, I think. Not just my stuff, but I think you know, writers are, roughly speaking, in the education business, and nothing strengthens you like that for the outside world. Then you have your own thoughts that you can smile at. You know, when the outside world seems at its most demonic and infernal.
Who are among the writers you find most delectable when trying to isolate oneself against the worst excesses?
Well, as Nabokov said, and he's one of my favorites, the way to deal with the gangster in the book is not to have a tiptoeing assassin come up behind him, but to show the sort of stupid and vulgar way that he cleans his ear with a questing fingertip. You know, the way to deal with villainy is to laugh at it, and Dickens, I think, is a good example of that. Nabokov himself. Don't punish and try and convert them, just laugh them off the stage.
Nabokov spoke once about autobiography and fiction, and he said that he gives characters details of his own life or that of his family the way you might pin a medal on a general. Do such details enter your work?
I'm sorry, what did you think he meant by that?
That for a character to be like the writer was to praise the character, to give the character a special kiss. You know, Nabokov always is reaching in and rescuing those characters, like in Ben Sinister, where he literally saves a character from death.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he has a funny relationship with his characters. He also says that his characters are so well disciplined that they cringe as he walks by with his whip. I don't know. I think I'm more on the, you know, if novels are half about novels and half about life, Nabokov is leaning towards novels being about novels. I'm leaning a bit more to them being towards life. And when my characters tend to take over and run the show up to a point, and when I come past with my whip, they just give me a sneer and go on doing what they're doing.
I thought we would give... because when you hear the plot of this book, you will have no choice but to want to read it. A quick précis in this final section of the initial problem in the book. The narrator is thrilled. He has run across a situation that he says will make a very great thriller. He's sure that after years of being unable to write, that this will solve his problems. What is this situation? He bears home at the book's beginning.
Well, he says that this is a murder story. I can't believe my luck, he says. And that's the central moral dilemma of the book, in that he has to abet the murder if he's going to write it down. It's about a girl who... who has always believed that she will die on her 35th birthday and will be murdered. She knows everything about the murder except who's going to do it. And this is her quest for her murder, for her murderer. She is the murderer. And there are two or perhaps three candidates. And she has to, like an artist might plan something, like might plan a novel, she has to get all the ingredients together and stoke them up to the right temperature so that the act can take place.
Can you suggest anything to listeners who might want to be able to read your novels without fearing that they're being, as you suggested before, picked on or picked at or assaulted?
No, I think, well, I'll put it this way, that one of the main things that energizes me is a belief in a very intense relationship with my readers. In some novels, I pick them out, I individualize them, I stab a finger at them, and they're not a mass of faceless people to me. They are, I can sort of feel their presence, and the letters I get from my readers suggest that this is an intense relationship. And many of them are from women who find my women funny. The more politicized ones don't. So I would, you know, adduce those letters as that you are entering it into an intense experience.
But the ordeal can be survived, at least to write about.
I can be profited from by both.
I've been talking to Martin Amis, the author of the recently published London Fields. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Mouse.
Before we go ahead with Babbitt, I want you to hear this announcement. You'll be interested.
This is Peter Dennis inviting you to join me for the complete works of Winnie the Pooh by A.A. Milne. Come with me to an enchanted place and share adventures with Christopher Robin, Pooh, Piglet, and all their friends. The stories are about good companions having wonderful times.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.